Stephen Mayne, small shareholder. Just the first one on the accounts. We've got negative equity of $267 million if you believe the accounts. The market cap's 1.7 and the enterprise value is probably about 2.5. So it's a bit of a disconnect between what we're saying we're worth and what the market is saying we're worth. Wondering if you can explain that, a bit of the historical explanation of that. And I'm interested in hearing from John on what he reckons the 50% stake in XYZ is worth. We've got three Foxtel subscriptions. My kids are addicted to Nick Jr. My wife watches Sex and the City every night. And I can see how you get people hooked, and obviously it is a pretty valuable asset. But I'm interested in your thoughts, given that the accounts are so inaccurate. I'd like some sort of insight as to, given you've highlighted XYZ today, as to what you reckon it might be worth, were we to flog it.
Perhaps John, if I could just go first. I'd like to say that I'm seeing very pleased to hear the main family are active users of pay TV. They're obviously a very intelligent group of people. As regards the disjunct, what's so-called disjunct between the net asset value of the company and its market value, one is an accounting function and the other is a valuation function, but the two don't necessarily correlate. And obviously the former reflects the startup phase that this company went through in establishing its business over the last, how many years is it now, John? 1995, was it? 95, yeah. So, and in that, there was a lot of sunk costs in establishing a platform, obviously getting, as we saw today, the programming right, and we're in the process of trying to retrieve that back. But I don't think that the two necessarily mean that there's a disjunct. The valuation is the valuation, that's what a fair market. Willing seller, willing buyer, pair to exchange script in this company for, and that's the more accurate valuation of the company. On the subject of inaccuracy of accounts, I don't think that's factually correct. In fact, I'm positive it isn't. We have audited accounts, have ever since we've been listed, and that will obviously continue on. And we pay a lot of attention to the micro detail in those accounts. So. I think it would be an exaggeration to suggest they were inaccurate at this stage. Is there anything else that you want to...
The XYZ question, I'd be happy to answer that.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Look, we value XYZ in the books at $40 million. The fact of the matter is that it's very hard to disaggregate our investment in XYZ from the value in AllStar, because a lot of the value creation moves to AllStar because of the level of investment that XYZ makes in new programming, new product. The emphasis in XYZ is about quality, and hence the attractiveness of the channels that it offers. If XYZ was a standalone business, some might say that it's over-investing in its platform because it's really investing to help grow the platforms of its shareholders and not so much to deliver a financial return to its shareholders. The financial return is derived from our ability to acquire a new customer, to attract and retain customers to the platform. You would have seen a lot of bright, shiny faces in terms of we have a lot of talent in XYZ. Each one of those channels has some real high quality talent, and I mean Kyle and Maude at Nickelodeon are fantastic. I mean there's a number of people who we retain just to give a face to the platform, and our investment in exclusive and original content we punch way above our weight. So that's the value of XYZ, if you will. And although we only value it at $40 million, it clearly has much more value to us in that regard. But since we never intend to sell it, it's going to be hard for us to realize that value.
Look, did you want to follow up there? Just on the market value versus the book value. I think the market value is based on future cash flows. You also might note that we've returned nearly $500 million in the last couple of years as well. So that needs to be added back when you're looking at accounting versus market value. So. It's not quite as simple as looking at the balance sheet and then looking at the share price.
In the absence of anyone else, Mr. Chairman, this one preliminary. Why doesn't a broadcasting company broadcast its AGM on the internet? I know you don't like the internet, but most companies broadcast their AGMs. I emailed you yesterday and said, are you doing it? You said no. And I said, I wouldn't mind getting a record of last year's AGM. They said, we'll give you the minutes. Now, come on. Let's get in the 21st century. Companies are now broadcasting their AGMs, leaving the full audio on their website so people can go back and look at it. And I'd like you to commit next year you'll do the right thing by your 6,000 shareholders, not just those who turn up and webcast it, and also that you make available the AGM debate. I mean, you know, I've seen some great videos and had some discussion and great presentation, and it's a shame that the rest of the shareholders who aren't here, or analysts or your customers, can't actually find out more about what you're doing.
Thank you, that's a sensible suggestion.
Thank you. And my last question on general business was a bit confused with the regulations of this industry. The Labor government came in and people kept on saying they didn't have a media policy at all. And I'm just wondering, is that actually correct, that the Labor Party didn't actually say what they were going to do with our industry? And then I was a bit worried when Wayne Goss got appointed to be chairman of the free-to-air lobby group. And he, of course, is, you know, Kevin Rudd's one of his best mates and sat on his wife's board till last year. And I thought, oh, here we go. It's a classic Labor insider's job. And the free-to-air industry, you know, the old oligopoly, hire the Prime Minister's old mate, and the pay TV industry will continue to get shafted. So I see there's now talk they're not going to auction off these new channels that we were looking at potentially bidding for. People are talking about the regulatory playing field being tilted against us now. Can you just give us some sort of comment on what's going on, and which Labor mate have we got representing us in Canberra to balance off what Wayne Goss is doing?
John or Dan?
So really, free TV were following our lead in terms of appointing an independent form of politician to represent our views. But we are awaited with great interest, as much as anyone else, where the government ended up going on last day, and everything else. We're obviously having discussions with them on things like this afternoon, and trying to get a fairer outcome for everyone on that. Frankly, I think the Minister has had his hands full with telecoms policy rather than focusing on media policy so far. So they've only been in office a few months. We'll probably give them a bit of a go, and we'll see what happens in the next few months.
I'll be very politic, yeah. And I'll be unpolitic. And I say, I think we're on record as saying that there's no industry in history that's received a better ride than the broadcast industry in Australia. Recent pronouncements by the Minister do not give us any warm feeling that that's going to change anytime soon. Why the government feels that it's got to protect the interests of U.S. private equity companies and Canadian broadcasters beyond me. The fact of the matter is that the stated policy objectives of the government to bring about digital migration, quality, high definition, et cetera, have been driven by the capital resources of All Star and Foxtel. And the government continues to ignore that fact and reward a free air industry that is in decline and reducing its investments in technology and local content. An industry that has been sold, lock, stock, and barrel to foreign investors. And I don't understand the policy positioning of the current government. Thanks for asking.
I just add to it, in my short period of time in this industry, the media seems to love talking about the media, and every page of practically any magazine at some stage during the year is full of another rumour or whatever. So I would regard what we're seeing now as pretty much business as usual as far as the media is concerned, but nonetheless.
Chairman, I noticed there was $100 million voted against the remuneration report. I might come back to that when we get to John Porter's election. But almost $200 million against Mr. Dick. There was obviously some sort of issue with a couple of your bigger institutional shareholders. Are you aware of what their concern is? Is it an independence question? Something's going on there. If you take out the Liberty stock, it's sort of 40-60 almost in terms of the vote, which is very rare in director elections in Australia. So wouldn't mind some context if you could provide that, please.
The first point, I guess, to note is that John's actually not an independent director. The independent director of the state, Justin Yarrow and I, is a Liberty appointee. And to your first question, am I aware of any reasons for that? No, I'm not. No shareholder has spoken to me on this particular subject. Perhaps spoken to another subject, but not this particular subject. I don't know if anyone can add any further to that.
Well, yes, there was one point raised, some people misunderstand the timing issues in regard to Mr. Amos's status as an independent director. They have questioned that, but we're very comfortable with that. We've had legal advice to that extent, and that we don't see an issue. But though there were some people who had an issue with Mr. Amos's independence and therefore weren't prepared to vote for Mr. Dickinson as an independent director, so it was really a technical issue from their point of view about whether or not Mr. Amos had independent status. So that was where that was coming from.
I'm wondering if we can flesh out what the issue with the remuneration report was. Clearly, it looks like one of the proxy advisors has taken an issue. I presume it's probably with John's pay, so I'd be interested in finding out what the issue was. Also, well done for putting him up for election, because CEOs don't have to face the poll. A lot of them, like Sol Trujillo, don't bother. Rupert Murdoch wasn't elected for 40 years at News Corp using that exemption. So well done for at least subjecting him to the vote. I'm interested as to whether he'll be serving a full term as CEO, given that he's, in terms of his length of service, he's getting a bit long in the tooth. And you often have a problem with the CEOs who make a pile, and John's now the happy shareholder of 16 million Austar shares. He's not on the BRW rich list, but I do a rich list of anyone worth more than 10 million, so he's on mine. I'm just wondering, given that he's made his pile, whether he's actually committing to serve as a full 3-year term as a director and as the CEO.
Let me address that in two roles, one as chairman of the meeting today and also chairman of the Remuneration Committee. We have been very conscious of succession planning in the company, and that goes at all levels, not just at the job level. After the expiration of the recent long-term incentive plan, I looked John in the eye and said, well, what do you want to do and how long are you going to be here for? And I was very reassured by his comments. I mean, John is a very active guy. Whilst he likes playing golf, I can't see him doing that more than once a week. He wants to continue to work for many years to come and has committed to effectively doing that with this company, for which we're very pleased. The point I wanted to make on the depth of the bench here is that we are always looking at succession planning at all levels, and including John's. And part of the comments that part of the purpose of the new remuneration policy that we've implemented is to dig deeper into the organisation and spread the opportunity of appreciation wider to engender that very solid underpinning of executives to come through. So, I don't know whether I can answer your question sufficiently, but don't know, John, whether you'd like to pledge yourself for the rest of your life or?
Yeah, sure. Two comments. One is I have recently signed a new 4-year contract, so I'm very committed to seeing Austar through the next phase of its evolution. Secondly, I am aware that there was a question of one of the proxy advisors relative to the remuneration report in that they believe that management incentive is better aligned with net profit as opposed to operating cash flow. So we're very strongly of the view, and it is underpinned by advice that we've gotten from Mercer Compensation Benefits Consulting, that in a growth company such as ours, that operating cash flow is the best measure of this company's performance, and then management's incentive should be aligned with operating cash flow. And if you look at the linkage between operating cash flow and shareholder returns, in the period of 2003 to 2008, February 03 to February 08, Austar delivered the 8th highest return for shareholders in the country, and excluding commodity companies, the highest. during a period of time in which its operating cash flow improved substantially. I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but essentially going from $30 million to $200 million. So there is a very strong linkage there. We think it's the right answer, but I think that's the nature of the against votes.
Okay.
Any other questions out there?
What was this independence question? What was the argument they put to say that Roger wasn't independent?
Roger was former work for KPMG and was an audit partner of KPMG and been auditor from the intersection of the Department of Independence in any event. But there are some aspects and asset rules around the timing from which when someone is a material consultant to a company as to when they can then become classified as or considered to be independent. That's a 2-year rule. It's now actually 25 months since Roger was last actively involved in working with OSCO on those things. So,
was he the former audit signing partner?
He was, but it's well over 2 years since that's the case. So based on legal advice and the consideration of the board of course that form the view that Roger is definitely an independent director. And that background is certainly very, very, very beneficial to his understanding of the company and the placement of Justin.
I guess it's ironic. I remember having a go at Justin at the 2001 AGM as the former chairman of the HIH Audit Committee, which had collapsed a couple of months earlier. And I think Justin is the only survivor from the HIH board who's actually gone on and sustained a career as a non-executive director. And based on the performance we've seen at Austar, I think he's done very well for us. But it is ironic that all those criticisms about audit partners becoming directors came out of the HIH situation, where all those Arthur Andersen people like Justin came out of Arthur Andersen and went on to HIH, and then there was a view that the audit wasn't as independent as it might have been. HIH was a company which never made a loss and collapsed with a $5 billion deficit. So I guess it's all ancient history, but so there's no issues with associations with Liberty, is the key point.
No.
No, right. So it's all about audit independence, which
it's
is
all
box tickers.
Yeah.
All right, okay, thanks. Can you just explain the accounting as to how we can do capital returns and buybacks when our balance sheet says that we have negative equity of $267 million? And will the effect of this be that we're going to have even bigger negative equity in the future? I notice negative equity has risen from $55 million to $267 million over the year. We have these bizarre $200 million cash flow business with a $200 million reduction or increase in its negative equity position as claimed in the balance sheet. I mean, I don't know how you can possibly say this is anything vaguely accurate. It's completely inaccurate. But what will it mean if we do this? Are we going to become a negative $500 million company according to what the auditor signs off on the accounts, or how will it work?
I think to make sure you get a very accurate answer on that, I might just refer to our CFO, Philip, if you mind.
Yes, well, any return of capital will increase the negative equity position. But that's not really an issue, because we can borrow the funds at a much cheaper rate than the cost of equity. So it actually makes perfect logical sense. It's not unusual for some of companies like ours around the world to do these sorts of things.
But I'm asking about the accounting. I agree it's logical, but I'm saying, how do you account for it? What accounting standard says that a company with negative equity can buy back share and return capital? I mean, how do you do that?
Well, you can. The accounting standards do allow for this.
Yes, John, because I just add a comment that you're absolutely right. Accounting, there's a lot of accounting that is nonsense. And it gets back to the question that you asked before, one of our major assets is not on the balance sheet, which is the cash flows that we have incurred costs in obtaining, and which have a obviously discounted cash value that were we to be able to book them, effectively would put the balance sheet, the equity into positive. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And also, some years ago, we actually, during that hard times, we actually wrote a lot of things down, and that probably have some of those things have a market value more than is on the balance, they carry value in the balance sheet. But there is nothing in accounting standards that says that you can't do a return of capital, and you do a return of capital, and the effect of that is you know, the other side of the entry is one side goes to shareholders, the other side increases the negative equity. It's as simple as that. We're not the only company like this, but the main problem is really that the assets aren't on the balance sheet, and accounting standards doesn't let you book those assets.
Mm-hmm.